Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Person has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore.
Oh! Stop! Oh!
Brother. Leave Toledo, Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast at thepodiumgame.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Craich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I'm looking forward to this episode. This is one that we've had in the coffers for quite a while. This has been on the long-standing Google Doc that we have running, where we continually come up with show ideas before we even record other show ideas. So they just keep getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And this is one I think we've had on almost since the beginning or near the beginning. I'm really excited to talk about it. It's a topic near and dear to my heart as well. So.
Yeah, so we are going to talk about, I guess you could say it's the history of losing, the right. The biggest losers ever in NBA history, at least some of them. We're going to talk about a few of our favorite or best known terrible teams.
Favorite terrible team. I know you do, and I absolutely have favorite terrible teams.
Well, so. Yeah, I mean, I think both favorite and notable, I think, is kind of what we're going to cover here. So we're going to go through a few of, notable ones, a little bit in depth, not too deep, because, you know, you don't want to get too sad about things. after a while, you know, you just kind of... You know,
if you're
going
to have great teams, though, somebody has to lose, though, too, for the Bulls to win 72. You know what I mean? Like, that, so, you know, there's the give and the take. If you want good teams, you got to have bad.
I mean, I agree with you, Rich. I'm not arguing.
If you want a 45, like everybody has 45 wins, or I mean, I don't want that. I want my good and I want my bad.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being terrible. I mean, it's... you know, it's just part of life. Some things you're bad at. Like
like us in this podcast. Yeah, we're terrible.
Oh, Rich.
No. Oh, I'm sorry.
There you go.
Well, I thought you knew we were terrible. You thought we were good.
I assume so. I thought we were okay. Improving.
Oh, no. I mean, the other podcast, the one that you just started, which allows you to plug here, that one is good. This one, eh.
Yeah, the Albert Hitchcast.
That is the one, yes.
On the stick doc. At onthestick.com/AlbertHitchcast. Yeah,
I've heard of that, yeah.
Thank you. Yes,
that one is better than this.
I don't know about that, Rich. I mean, you're a good contributor. You know, you got the you're the numbers guy. You're the you know, you got the info. You got the details. I think we do a nice job. They haven't thrown us off yet. You know, we're like 16, 17 shows in. You know, we have more wins than many of these teams that we're going to be talking about today. So, Rich, we hear a lot about tanking. And yeah. We've made a lot of jokes about how tanking, of course, has never happened before until the, you know, recent Philadelphia 76ers.
Right. So evil Sam Hinkie decided, ruin the NBA.
He said, damn it, I don't want to win. I want to lose exceptionally so that I can gather draft picks and form an ingenious plan to, I don't know. I guess eventually they want to win. But so, I don't know. Like, I've always. I feel like tanking has become an all-purpose term for just like general badness, and I guess it's sort of like an intending to be bad on like you form a team knowing that is going to be bad and are okay with that because you believe it will, you know, prove great dividends in the end.
Right.
Now, my view on tanking was always more of it. Players and or coaches sort of intentionally playing to lose, like actually like not playing as hard as they can or actually throwing the game. And whether that's really ever happened in NBA history, it's kind of hard to tell. But what's your stance on that?
Yeah, I've always felt, to me, when I think of tanking, I don't think of a team like this current Sixers. I really don't think that they're that. I think there's a construct there. I mean, obviously the Sixers are constructed to not win games, but I never see that as necessarily quote-unquote tanking. To me, it's always been, and we'll talk about some examples, you know, in a little bit here. To me, tanking has always been, we have an okay team, you know, maybe halfway through the year, we're 500, this, or whatever. Then we look in the mirror and go, okay, look, we're not going to compete for a championship. You know, we might have a protected first-round pick. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that we're going to get into here and a bunch of different factors that lead to teams doing what I'm sort of describing here is that, you know, we can't make the playoffs. We don't have a title team. You know, we're lucky to even get, you know, an eight seed. What's worth it getting an eight seed? I'd rather get a lottery pick, all this sort of stuff. And then sort of in ways, shutting guys down, you know, playing guys a lot of minutes that they don't deserve, or in a single game, like we're going to talk about another one where it's a single game where they looked in the mirror and went, oh crap, we probably need to lose this game, so let's have a guy that you know, usually doesn't do anything on our team play a lot, or you know, do a lot, or stuff like that. To me, that's always what I've always thought of as tanking, not necessarily a team that is constructed at the beginning of the year to be bad. I think that's a whole different animal to me. I think that's in a lot of ways smart, and we'll get into that a little bit, where and I'm not necessarily saying that tanking intentionally is dumb either. Like where I'm saying, where, you know, if you're halfway through the season and you realize we can't make the playoffs, it's not the worst thing ever to, like, you know, make your team intentionally worse so that you get a better draft pick or you get in the lottery and not the eighth or seventh seed in the playoffs or something like that. I don't necessarily know if it's good or bad or whatever, but yeah, I've never felt that what the Sixers are doing right now or some certain stuff of what people call tanking is. To me, it's always been intentionally as in a way of what you said, but also, you know, you might be able to put out a better team, but you don't. You might be able to put out a better basketball product, but you don't. I don't think this current Sixers team was ever constructed to be better, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And I see the distinction, although I don't know, like, where I sort of, like, fall. Like, what, which is okay, which is not okay, or any of them bad. I mean, I definitely have a problem. I mean, I have a problem with two things. Obviously, I would have a problem with, like, if someone actually went out there and just, like, didn't try, just you know, if players or coaches or whatever, if the team that they fielded that night decided, we're not going to try as hard, we're going intentionally to this game. Like, I feel like that is a line that should not be crossed. I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, it would be awesome if every team out there was built to win as many games as possible, and there weren't the incentives that there are in the NBA to lose more to have a better chance at a top pick.
Right, and it's a little bit worse, too, in the NBA as well, because you mentioned the big caveat of the top pick, which is usually also, you know, kind of comes with a generationally great player. And what we found is, you know, generation great players. Sorry, my dogs are not happy about this discussion of tanking. I know, no, guys.
They're like against tanking.
They are very much against tanking. But, you know, you look at it, especially in the NBA, where MLB, yeah, okay, there's obviously reasons why in baseball you'd want, you know, a top five pick or whatever, and the numbers say that or whatever. But nothing changes your franchise around like having that one guy, drafting a LeBron, drafting a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, drafting, you know, that is completely transcendent of, you know, anything. And the NBA, there's no way to ever get around that, because the NBA is always going to be a league where there's, you know, there's five guys on your team, and whenever you want to give your best player the ball, you can give him the ball. I mean, no other sport has that, where you can, whatever you want, you say, best player, here, it's all yours. You're like, you do everything for us. I mean, baseball, obviously, there's a lineup. Football, you know, you can't, there's always different stuff in the bigger sports, whereas basketball, that one guy, that one out of five, can just change so much. So I get it. I really do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of weird because, like, you know, we were sort of looking into this, like, history of tanking issue, because I've never read anything about there really being, like, a perception of any team tanking before, like, 1983 or so. You know, that we're going to talk about them in more detail, but the 83 and 84 Rockets are, like, the first team that you kind of hear about is in, like, oh, yeah, they were tanking to get, you know, to get Ralph Sampson and Hakeem Olajuwon. And I've never read anyone before that ever seen that, and in our research we didn't really see that much of that either, and that does seem sort of odd, because the incentives were largely the same. I mean, from 66 to 85 they had a basically the two worst teams in each conference had a coin flip to determine who would be first pick and who would be second pick. That was every year, and that surprised me. You know, I knew about coin flips for like Kareem and for Magic and for maybe a few other players, but I'd always just assumed like, oh, it was just because there was some tiebreaker that needed to be broken. I didn't.
Right.
And that's interesting because, of course, that could mean a team with a, you know, obviously, you know, this season, the team that is maybe not quite, because the Timberwolves.
Yeah, I was going to say the Timberwolves. Yeah, the Timberwolves are going to make. Yeah.
There are certainly seasons in which, you know, there are going to be they're just going to be teams who in the West who the worst team in the West is going to finish with a much better record than the first team in the East, or vice versa. So, and that certainly, you know, happened throughout the draft. But that wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't think that would really make that much of a difference, because you still have the incentive to, you know, if you're in a certain position, to be the worst in your conference and get that coin flip at least. I mean, you get it if you have the worst, you know, one of those worst records, you still have a 50% chance of getting the pick, or, you know, get the second pick at worst, and, you know, goes by record after that. So it's not, you know, it's not like there wouldn't have necessarily been a reason to tank before that.
Better reason. I mean, honestly, a better reason. Right. I mean, the 50% chance is pretty, I mean, that's a real race to the bottom, as opposed to, you know, today where, you know, obviously there's lottery balls, but we've seen plenty of times where, you know, the worst team is, I mean, they have a chance of, you know, obviously they're still going to be, you know, top five or whatever, but yeah, they don't always get that number one pick and very rarely get that number one pick for being the worst team. So
yeah. Do you have any thoughts on like why that might be?
In terms of the why we never heard more about it?
Were just teams more secretive about it, or because basketball wasn't covered as well?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. Without living, you know, in that era, I'm not necessarily aware if we just kind of remember these teams as being bad or you know. But we looked through the SI Vault, we looked through a bunch of different articles and all that sort of stuff, and there was never really many articles or much, you know, sports media talking about this team intentionally trying to lose, or, you know,
yeah,
kind of tongue in cheeky. And even when we do read this, there's very rarely, you know, especially in Sports Illustrated or whatever, where they would say X team is attempting to lose to get. I mean, they would always say, yeah, we didn't field the best team, or yeah, we kind of knew our roster wasn't very good, you know, sort of dancing around it tongue in cheek or whatever. But yeah, you never really got that before, which I don't know why. I don't know if it wasn't just as transparent. I don't know if the media just didn't catch on, or I even wonder if teams, I mean, it seems unfathomable that teams wouldn't think, hey, this is a really good idea, we should just lose on purpose or whatever. Or, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say without being in the context. I can't imagine that they didn't know, you know, especially when Kareem's coming out. Hey, you know what? If we're bad, we have a better chance of getting Kareem. But you just don't hear about it all that
often.
So it is very weird. But I can't – I'm going to give them – well, then again, NBA GMs back in the day were pretty ridiculous. So they might not have known. So they just drank a lot and made really ridiculous trades. So that's possible. I mean, with the Celtics mostly. So.
Yeah. I mean, a few things. The draft wasn't necessarily as valued anyway. And there wasn't, of course, rookie scale contracts. You weren't going to get like cheap talent in the
right.
You know, even if you got a star, you're going to have to pay him pretty quickly. So that might be one thing. Also, you know, in the 70s and so, we're much closer to past basketball point shaving scandals in college, like, you know, in the 50s, and I think in the 60s as well, that, you know, kind of haunted the game. So maybe there's just some reticence to play around with losing it all. You know, you're still, the box office of the game is tenuous. So maybe, you know, teams feared, like, if they had any, you know, if at all they felt like if there was ever that perception they were losing, that would hurt them at the box office.
That makes a lot of sense. That's actually really good. I really didn't think about that in my initial stuff, but yeah, that's a really good idea now, where, you know, the Sixers or whatever have X amount of, you know, guaranteed, you know, corporate, you know, skyboxes and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's a lot less. They're going to make money anyway. The television contract, all this sort of stuff, they're going to make a pretty penny this year, regardless of if they win 9 games or if they win 49 or whatever. Whereas, in the 70s, you really can't be, you can't play around with it too much. I mean, I grew up in an era where the Bulls were no good, and I mean, I didn't grow up in that era, but no, you know, knowing, you know, what happened in the 70s and the 80s with the Bulls before Jordan, they were a nothing in the city. They were playing in front of 3,000, 4,000 people just because they weren't good. I mean, there's no reason to go see them. So, yeah, that is a very good point that you brought up there.
Yeah. Thank you. And I don't know. I do think that, I mean, they're probably a combination of all those things, but it is interesting that it is sort of like tanking is a fairly recent term as far as kind of like a widespread term, you know, I expected there to kind of be more about it in the past. Maybe we just didn't find the right stuff, but it's, you know, and there's still plenty of interesting things when it comes to teams that, you know, were really bad or even intentionally bad. But it's just it's kind of noteworthy that this is more of a perceived as a modern problem, you know, and I guess modern is in the last 30 years, which is, you know, there's enough history there to, you know, to definitely get into some depth. But I don't know, like, just last thing about this, would you like to see the system changed? You know, does it need to be solved? If so, do you have any ideas how you would want sort of the draft lottery, the trying to cut the incentives of tank to be changed? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. The problem is I don't know if there's ever going to be a perfect solution to it at all. I mean, there's like the wheel issue, you know, people have brought up the wheel and there's been a bunch of other things, you know, equally weighted balls and that sort of stuff. I think one way or another, and I mentioned it, you know, in my, you know, discussion a little bit ago, that no matter what in the NBA, there's always still that incentive that there's going to be one or two guys in those drafts. So there might only be one guy and it might only come once a decade or whatever, where everybody kind of agrees that this guy is probably the real deal or a guy that's really going to change your franchise, you know, Kevin Durant, LeBron, you know, those sort of guys. So I think no matter what, regardless of what system you do, you know, Bill Simmons had the idea of, well, the team that just missed the playoffs should do it. But then you're gonna have people trying to get to there. You're gonna have the, you know, the team that's in the eighth seed is gonna start trying to lose so they can be the last one out or whatever. I mean, there's always gonna be, no matter what, I think, some sort of finagling with the order or figuring out how guys can do it. The wheel is probably one of the best ones I've seen yet, the kind of the draft wheel. That one sort of eliminates a lot of the issues. I don't know if it all the way does.
To explain for anyone who doesn't really know what the draft was, basically, like, you get it sort of rotates. So you get a choice between 1 through 5 or 6 through 10 or, you know, wherever you kind of land in a certain year. It doesn't depend on your record. You just sort of land there and you basically get, if there's like 30 spots for 30 years, you're going to pick in one spot each year, depending on how things work out.
Yeah, and I like that one, but you know what's going to happen. Sometimes some really good team is going to get a really good player, and then people are going to go crazy about it and say, well, this is ridiculous. Why did anybody think this was going to work? And, sure. And there's always going to be issues no matter what with what you do. To me, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I know a lot of people really care a lot about it, and the Sixers are no good and all this sort of stuff. To me, I've never really thought it was that big of a deal. It's smart in a lot of ways. If your team's not going to be any good, there's no point in, you know, getting an eighth seed and getting destroyed by the best team in the East. I mean, sure, there are these random examples that come up, and I always hear people bring up, you know, the one or two examples of, no, well, remember when this eighth seed beat this one or whatever? They're few and far between, though. For the most part, an eighth seed, a seventh seed, a sixth seed, they don't win. They get destroyed in the playoffs. And you know, is it worth it to have 4 games of playoff revenue and then have a lesser pick or pick out of the lottery or not have a chance at a top 5 pick? And, you know, you have protected picks and you have all this sort of stuff that comes into it. To me, I've never thought it's a big deal because there's never really, I mean, yeah, ideally you'd want every single team to compete at full strength every single game or whatever. I just don't think it's that realistic. I just don't know if there's a chance. I mean, there's going to be some teams that are bad. And I don't, you know, I think as a GM, I'd rather position my team, if I knew I was going to be bad, I'd rather be really bad versus mediocre. You know what I mean? Mediocre gives you nothing. That's NBA hell for the most part. So I've never seen a huge problem in it, but some others do. So,
yeah. I would say the wheel is interesting. I don't know if that's really practical. I do. They ended up voting it down, but I thought that the kind of the reform idea they had, where it sort of, it wasn't quite like every team has equal odds, but it sort of made it like, you know, like the worst 6 teams had similar odds and it kind of decreased from there. I thought that was a tweak that was, might make it a little bit better. I mean, yeah, you're not going to completely eliminate it, but I think the closer to even the odds are for those non-playoff teams, with lessening odds for like the last 4 teams so that there's not incentive for an eighth seed to decide, oh, I'd rather be, you know, in this lottery rather than be in the playoffs, which I understand would kind of be there a little bit anyway, but that would lessen that temptation. And I think most players aren't going to go for that anyway. They'd rather be in the playoffs, and most coaches would feel the same way. But so I think something like that would make it a little bit better. But I agree that pretty much you're not going to be able to remove it. And I think there's a lot written about it. We've obviously spent almost 20 minutes talking about it now, but I do agree that I don't think it's some sort of like basketball crime or anything like that. Like I kind of admire in a sense what the Sixers are doing, like with just doing what they're doing without any pretense, rather than like for instance, the Magic signing like Luke Ridenour and Ben Gordon, and granted, they kind of want to be good. Like, you know, they signed Channing Frye. They're a little bit ahead of the development. You know, they have some better players, but I do think like just signing one of my favorite tanking team is an example of this, of just signing like veterans for basically no purpose, you know, other than just to have veterans there have some names. Right. but really, you know, I think I'd rather, like, instead of like a team trying to like, hey, we have this guy who was good 4 years ago, you know, we're gonna be all right this year, I'd rather just like, you know, I mean, I don't want them to like say, hey, we're gonna be bad, but I'd rather like I appreciate the 76ers not having pretense and having,
you know, being transparent honest about it.
Yes, yeah. As much as, you know, possible, you know. Yeah, that's so I think I do definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right with you on that.
All right, well, we're going to take a little break now, and then we will be back to talk about a few of our favorite examples of terrible teams.
I think it's time to blow this scene. Get everybody in the stuff together. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's jam.
And we are back, and we're going to start with the team that probably set the standards of badness, the 73 loss 1973 Philadelphia 76ers. Lots of sevens in there. Lots of bad numbers going on there. So I recently read the book Perfectly Awful by Charlie Rosen, which basically chronicles this team. And it's not a good situation. It's as far as the book goes, it is a book with some interesting stories, maybe not like the best writing ever. But, you know, if you're an NBA history fan, I do recommend checking it out. But, you know, it wasn't really one move that sunk the 76ers, but just a lot of bad ones. They hired Roy Rubin, who just ended up being a legendarily terrible coach. He was a small college coach and just did not fit at all in the NBA. He was a yeller and a guy who believed that good defense came from slowing down the pace of the game. that kind of stuff. You know, were there only, you know, there, of course, this 67 76ers, that five times fast. They were the 68 win championship team, you know, the greatest team in NBA history up until that time. And had, you know, they had Will Chamberlain, and they had Hal Greer, Billy Cunningham, and other great legends. And there's actually really good, there's a piece on the from SI in 73 talking about the team. At that point, they had like, they were like 3-36 or 3-39 or 3-35 actually. I'm looking at right now, and they have a chart with all the players who they had a chart with like their last five draft picks, and all of them like were terrible. Like, all of them played fewer than a season with the team. One guy didn't play at all. They just did nothing. And then they were like, we're talking about the still active members of the 76ers team, and they're all like still like doing pretty well. Like Will Chamberlain's with the Lakers, and, you know, they'd obviously just won a championship. Billy Cunningham, who was their most recent star, he went to the ABA. Chet Walker was playing well in Chicago, and so on and so forth. The only one who was really left on the team was Hal Greer, and really the you know, Hal Greer is kind of a forgotten guy now, but he was a 7-time All NBA team member, yeah. 10 All-Star games, a Hall of Famer, you know, really, you know, a big legend for that team. And the way he's just, you know, he's 36, he's done his last legs, but the way he just kind of gets jerked around the entire season is just it's just really sad. I mean, he goes from, like, you know, like they say, oh, we're gonna play you, to, you know, being benched for weeks and months on end. He ends up playing, like, I think let's see, I have it right here. He ends up playing 38 games, 848 minutes, doesn't play like the last 30 games of the season. And there's a like the fans are like chanting for him to like play like in the last game, but he's already told coach, like, you know, hey, I'm not in any shape to play a game. I haven't played in, you know, in 2 months, like, you know, don't put
36. So yeah, you can't put calling me every 2 months.
And... Right. Don't put me out there. I can't, I just can't do it anymore. So the fans are pissed because they think that the coach at that point was Kevin Lowry, who had taken over for Roy Rubin after about 50 games. Actually, it's funny because they actually won a stretch of 5 out of 7 games during the season. So the rest of the season, they only managed to win 4 games, which is pretty incredible. I guess that would be, what, 4 out of 75 games?
Yeah, not bad.
So
not good, but not bad.
Yeah, not good. So
yeah, when you're just, I'm looking at these draft picks right now. When Bud Ogden is your best first round pick in 5 years, that's probably probably not good.
They made a lot of dumb trades as well. I mean, they just, but like, it was nothing, like, from everything I can tell, there was no intention to be bad here. Like, they were trying to, I mean, they understood they were rebuilding, but they did not expect to be that bad. One of my favorite stories from the book is about John Q. Trapp, who played just a little bit with the 76ers that year. And when they're playing in Detroit, apparently Roy Rubin wants to pull Trapp out of the game. And then, like, he either Trapp points or somehow gets the attention of somebody in the stands who like opens up their coat and shows like a gun there. And so, like, he just keeps Trapp in the game. So I
mean, I would.
Yeah, I probably would, too. So, yeah, some crazy stories in that book. But I mean, their best player was probably Fred Carter, whose nickname was Mad Dog, which came from biting Charlie Scott on the shoulder. It was basically like a good player who, but just not, you know, like, not a guy who could carry a team, obviously. Right. And he credited himself with inventing the fist bump.
Ooh,
I have no idea whether that's true.
Does anybody? I don't know. Yeah, wow, that
would be pretty impressive if it were true. I mean,
he'd be making a lot of money now if he did.
It would have been smart. Yeah.
Gee, I don't know. Yeah, that's. My dogs do not believe that.
No, they don't believe. Yeah, they don't believe the Mad Dog.
That was not him. Wow, that's really, yeah. How can you prove that? I don't know. Yeah, go with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Exactly.
That's it.
Might as well.
I don't know how you could prove one way or another.
I don't know. And it's funny because, like, you know, this is like portrayed as like a reputation destroying type thing. But, you know, really, they just cleaned house the next season. They got Doug Collins was who they ended up picking in the draft. The book focuses a lot on them trying to woo Bill Walton out of college, you know, mm-hmm. thinking that Bill Walton might, you know, might come out and so forth. And he would have been the big prize, obviously, but he didn't come out for another year. So they got Doug Collins, who was pretty good, but had a lot of injuries. And then, you know, within the next couple of years, they got George McGinnis and Julius Erving, and, you know, were a championship, you know, they went to, I think, 4 finals out of 6 seasons, and, you know, and were fine. And obviously were, you know, became one of the, you know, had a great run, finally winning the title in 83. So it didn't take that long for them to turn things around, is my point. So I do think that sometimes we think, you know, there's sort of this thing about, like, oh, the culture is going to get terrible on, you know, on a team that, you know, is so bad or tanks or whatever, and it's not able to be turned around. But in most cases, you know, it can be turned around. I mean, there are some, you know, repeated year after year bad teams that I know we'll talk a little bit about, like some of the Clipper teams and some of the Grizzlies teams and so forth. But it doesn't really seem like it seems like, these things are generally reversible.
Yeah, right. More times than not, once you start getting some good players in and start winning, the culture of losing is pretty well gone. But yeah, there are obviously examples, but a lot, we'll see. And when we'll break down a lot of the worst teams of all time, if we look at those, there's not a lot of them in there that really were bad for, you know, really, really long time. A lot of times the bottoming out sort of led to success, you know, not that long after. So it's a pretty interesting study there.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we of course have the another really famous example, and basically the teams that sort of led to that led to the institution of the NBA lottery, the 83 and 84 Houston Rockets. So yeah, they knew they were rebuilding. I don't know if the 83 team is really, if you could really say that they were necessarily like a tanking team. Like the 83 team going for Ralph Sampson, I mean, they knew that they were going to be bad, but I think they were just genuinely like awful. Like, I don't think they needed to do anything extra to be bad. I mean, they had, you know, they had Caldwell Jones, who they got in the Moses Malone trade, but he was 32, and you know Elvin Hayes, who was 37. And Calvin Murphy was 34. So, and Billy Paulson was 34. He didn't play much. So, I mean, they had a bunch of guys who, you know, all the name players on that team were, you know, definitely on the wrong side of age of 30. But the interesting thing, and I know you looked up an article for this, is just how like much they didn't seem to like mind losing.
Yeah, no, and the article, and you can look it up on the SI Vault as well, and maybe if people want, we can link it on the Twitter account as well. But it's called "The Race for Ralph" is the name of the article, and it's the first real instance that I could find in SI where there was an article written about a team, you know, losing and losing with some amount of purpose or whatever. And you could say, like you said, yeah, I think that team was going to be bad regardless, whether they, you know, quote, wanted to lose or not. But the details in there are basically saying that, yeah, I mean, these guys, they're not really upset about losing. I mean, they're not tossing and turning at night wondering, how do we fix this right now? You know, we need to do this. You know, there's quotes about, you know, the image of the NBA and having such a terrible team and what that would do to the image of the NBA. You know, talking about how they had the Cavaliers' first round pick via trade as well as their own. So they set out, here's the exact quote: "The Rockets, possessed of Cleveland's first round pick via trade as well as their own, set out late last October with a chance to make the ultimate pick. they were the least in the West, holding the pick of a pygmy of the East. Houston didn't tarry." It's quite a elegant little piece here. "Houston didn't tarry, losing its first 10 games and sinking to the bottom Western Conference. It was doubly cheered to see Cleveland lurch to a 33-22 record in the East." So it a lot of ways turned into a perfect storm of them, where, you know, Houston had their first round pick and they knew they were going to be bad, but then it was awesome because Cleveland was bad too and they had their first round pick. So it really looked like a really good situation for them. And yeah, in all the quotes that you see with the general managers, he goes, "When we started the season, we figured we'd be in the coin flip. So we thought we whatever, dude. Yeah. This is from general manager Ray Patterson. Again, he says, "Every game we played, I emotionally wanted to win, but logically, you can absorb the losses." So everything was done looking forward to next year. And one NBA team official says, "Ray Patterson has done anything or hasn't done anything this year except sit around and talk at meetings. He just left the club with all those older players." So essentially, that there was no intention of getting them better. There was no calls being made by Ray Patterson to say, "Hey, we have this guy and we want this guy. And, you know, we need a power forward. We need that." I mean, it's just basically, we're just going to let this kind of go and do what it is. And in ways, it's really not a bad plan he had, especially when he had the Cleveland pick. And when he mentions that they saw that Cleveland was bad too, it was like, well, you know why, you know, we're good. Like, this is exactly what we want. So it's one of those situations where you can't really fault the team. But yeah, I think it was, I don't know if it was as much intentional as it just sort of happened as well. But sure. The 84 season, we'll get into that. That might have been a little different.
That's a different, that's a different circumstance. I mean, just, you know, on the 83 season, yeah, I mean, because Cleveland, you know, they were terrible every year there, and they were always trading away their picks. So a lot of teams took advantage of, you know, the dumb things that they able to do.
Why did they do that?
Well, you know.
You always look through history. You're like, Cleveland traded the first pick. Like, why are you trading that? Like, what are you doing? Like, just keep that guy.
Yeah.
And then, like, so, everybody always drafts really good players with them, too. They're like, oh, we just got, like, you know, Magic Johnson with the pick. And it's like, dude, just keep your damn pick. Like, why are you trading those? Like, wasn't Magic Johnson the result of a Cavaliers first-round pick?
No, he was the Jazz.
I always mix up the Jazz and the Cavs in terms of,
Gail Goodrich, yeah.
Gunslinging GMs. They're just giving away first-round picks. Like, it's just, I guess, when we talk about GMs being different in those days, I mean, that's a shining example. I mean, there's very few times where it really happens as much as it happens. Nowadays, you'll get the stuff where, you know, 15 years later, they decided, you take that 2027 first round pick. We'll see what happens or whatever. You know, like the Baron Davis to the Clippers deal gets, you know, Baron Davis to the Cavs gets, you know, Kyrie Irving or whatever. So you get those situations every so often. But to have it, it's just hilarious to see old gunslinging GMs that are just giving out first round picks like crazy. But, you know, hey.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm glad they did because it made it for fun. A podcast like this would barely be as much fun if we didn't know that, you know, the Jazz were just traded Magic Johnson. Like, you know, come on.
The mistakes of history make for interesting podcasts.
Exactly, right.
So, yeah, then, so Houston ended up with the first and third picks, and they got Ralph Sampson and Rodney McRae. And Sampson, you know, was good player, but was sort of... Yeah, he might be a player who might be better used now when we're sort of, you know, we can sort of accept in modern basketball a 7-4 guy who, you know, prefers to play away from the basket.
That was a terrible,
you know, it was like, what do you do? You know, you have to rebound.
Get your back to the basket and bang down low and you look at him now. I mean, you look at the body type that Ralph Sampson has now. You can really envision him in today's NBA being really good. I mean, obviously he doesn't have the shooting stroke of like a Kevin Durant, but he looks like, you know what I mean, in terms of his body structure, the height, all that sort of stuff. I mean, you could see how he'd so easily fit in to today's NBA. You know, doing pick and pops, pick and rolls, that sort of stuff. He'd be great in it. But yeah, as you mentioned, in those days, that was like sacrilegious to be a that tall and not be banging down low and getting rebounds and dunking every time he touched the ball. You know, it's unheard of. But today, I mean, it's amazing how good he might be today, you know, in today's NBA. But
and I imagine, you know, he probably had to adjust his game to play with Hakeem too. And you can kind of see, like, his best season was his rookie season. You know, it seemed like that was kind of when he played more comfortably. And then after that, I mean, was a pretty good player for a couple years, and then you fell off with injuries and other issues. He ended up being disappointed mostly because of injuries and just because of maybe not fitting the times or fitting, you know, the team, even though obviously they had a run to the finals in 86. McRae, you know, was a solid player, but didn't really do much. I mean, the Rockets had a chance to draft Byron Scott or Clyde Drexler, who was draft 14th in that year, who of course was a University of Houston guy. So, imagine if they'd been able to get Drexler and then Olajuwon the next year, that certainly would have, that a dynasty might have made. But, you know, I mean, they still had, you know, they had a pretty good run until it all kind of fell apart with the drug scandal and, you know, a lot of problems in the late 80s. And then, of course, you know, putting the other team together with Hakeem in the mid 90s and having a good run there. So eventually got good for them. But it took a couple of regime changes, so to speak, to actually kind of make that happen.
Yeah.
But. But then 84, I mean, that was really when they, when it got really bad. And there's a Sporting News article, kind of looking back on that. And yeah, basically at one point the Rockets were 24-37 and then they ended up finishing, 5-15, with 20 games to play. The Clippers finished, one game ahead of them. And then that would basically was Pat Williams, who was the general manager of the Sixers at the time. And the Rockets they had a deal with the Sixers could have gotten the number one or number two pick if it hadn't have been for the Rockets tanking. Essentially, they ended up going, they were lower and they got Charles Barkley, which wasn't a bad, you know, consolation prize, but they could have had Jordan or maybe Olajuwon if that hadn't have happened. But anyway, but they basically said, yeah, this is, you know, they went right after the season was done. They had an owner's meeting and no one's happy. And then they just said, they said no more coin flips. We're going to institute a draft lottery, and they basically did it immediately. So there was no pussyfooting around.
Not much of an owner's vote. Or if there was an owner's vote, it was pretty unanimous.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe one, maybe one team did not vote for it, but
they didn't have to talk about it too long, I guess. So
and that's when I talk about tanking, that's one. And especially if you look at that roster and who they were pulling out there and what they were doing, I mean, that was a pretty obvious one where it was, to me, and I'm not going to fault them for it. I mean, I don't know if it's a bad strategy, you know, given the rules that the NBA had at the time, but that's always what I think of tanking is when we look in the mirror and we go, you know what, it'd be better if we lost. That to me, in midseason, when you can have the chance to put out a better team and to have a chance to win, you intentionally, you know, maybe putting out a lesser product. That to me is always what I thought tanking was.
Yeah,
so.
And that was when they were playing Alvin Hayes, who's 38,
right,
a whole lot of minutes with the stated goal of getting him to 50,000 minutes in his career. And yeah, just they're clearly not playing. they clearly weren't sending guys out there to win. Which, you know, again, it's, you know, yeah, I. As long as the players who are in the game are playing as well, you know, as well as they can, I don't necessarily have a problem with that, even though it is a little bit like, you know, that's a little bit more of an ethical line for me than, you know, than just building a team that you want, you know, like, putting together a young team you don't know is going to be good, but wanting to get them good experience, I think, is different than like,
right,
throwing out like old guys and guys that you don't think have any future just because you want to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah. So, so we've talked about, of course, a couple of history's greatest losers. And, now we're going to talk about some losers that some our personal favorites, maybe, or ones that we experienced close up.
I depending on my age, I probably wouldn't consider these one of my favorites, but kind of growing up in it, I really enjoyed it. And that sounds horrible. I'm sure there's a lot of people that are older than me that live in Chicago that didn't enjoy the run of the Baby Bulls. But I, as a young basketball fan, enjoyed it because when I was watching, I was thinking, hey, you know, I'm ahead of the game here. I'm watching guys that are going to be future legends here. I'm watching Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler and Jamal Crawford. Like, I'm seeing the stars of the future. And Hersey Hawkins. I don't know who that guy is. I'm sure he's good or whatever. I mean, so you look at, I'm talking about the Baby Bulls here. I'm talking about, and this isn't really 1 year of tank. This is sort of, and again, I don't know if this is necessarily a tank as much as it is just a terrible team that's in a lot of ways intentionally terrible for a stated goal, but then at a certain point got past that and was like, okay, now get good. Oh God, we're still awful. Like, this is not good. You know, there was a few years where, hey, let's just, you know, generate picks, get these young players, and then we're ready to go. And it took forever to get them really going. It took until, you know, the mid-2000s, the Scott Skiles coach teams, to really do anything to get to the playoffs. And then, of course, it took, you know, Derrick Rose and Tom Thibodeau to really get to that next level. So it's been a long road for the Bulls to get where they're at. But, you know, looking at the Baby Bulls, obviously 1998-99, this is the breakup of the Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Jackson core. They all go their separate ways. Everyone's gone. The team is just in shambles. The best, you know, they're bad, but they're not so bad that we'd see a little bit later. I mean, they're not good. They're not good at all. But you still had Tony Kukoc, who was still a pretty good player in his own right, a guy that everybody sort of assumed on his own could do well and did okay on a team that wasn't very good. The depth wasn't there, though. There was not really many good guys. I mean, you had Brent Berry, a very young Brent Berry. As you mentioned, Dickie Simpkins, who should never get starters minutes and got starters minutes. Cornell David, of course, the famous Cornell David, right? What's your favorite Cornell David memory?
When you just talked about him right then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or playing as him in NBA Showtime is the only other acceptable answer of these two. For the Dreamcast, you can play as Cornell David. It's on the arcades as well. He's one of my favorite because I always had friends that were like, we'd go play that game in an arcade and they'd be like, the Bulls. And I'm like, all right, like, okay.
All right, sure.
And then they'd be like Cornell David and like BJ Armstrong. And they're like, oh, man. I was like, I told you. Like, and then I'm going to go be the Raptors and I have T-Mac and Vince Carter. And, you know,
yeah,
yay.
Better.
But yeah, they were always like, well, I got to be the Bulls. I'm like, all right, knock yourself out. Bill Wennington and Cornell David.
Cool.
I'm sure that's a good team. Yeah, I mean, those were the best three players after Kukoc. That kind of tells you what you have there.
They still had Ron Harper.
Yes. Oh, yeah. But he had, I guess he hadn't, was he that awful yet? I he was getting old, though. Because he was old even when the Bulls were good. I mean, he was 30, still.
Yeah, he was 35 at that point. Looking at, he had like a 14.7 PER, true shooting percentage of 451. So he was definitely in decline. At that point, and you know, he was a little bit less of a those metrics may not quite measure his worth as a player, but still, he was, not looking great for him.
And that's a very interesting team because there's still that kind of blend of old and new that we sort of talk about when you talk about teams that, you know, quote, tank or whatever. I don't know if this team necessarily intended to lose. I mean, it just sort of happened because of who was left on the team. But you still had six guys over the age of 30, rather. A nice little blend of old and new. And they really hadn't had a chance to get these really good draft picks. Well, after this year, they were able to get a number one pick. You know, they get Elton Brand. They had Ron Artest. There's a few other guys, but you're starting to get this influence of young talent. You're getting, you know, there's still six guys over 30, but they're starting to really kind of be faded out. And you're really starting to feature the newer guys, the younger Bulls, the what we call, you know, eventually the baby Bulls or whatever. You know, 2001, that's a team now we're full out baby Bulls. There's not a single player on that team that is over the age of 30. This is also the year where they missed out on signing Tracy McGrady, Tim Duncan. I think Grant Hill was another one of these free agents. This is a big free agent class. This is one that we always sort of talk about in history of a lot of teams shed a ton of payroll to get these guys. And the Bulls were one of those teams too that just assumed we're the Bulls. We're, you know, a historic franchise in the past decade. You know, we have cap space. Come on board, all these guys. And nobody came. And then they had to sign Ron Mercer.
Yeah.
And give Ron Mercer a lot of money to be essentially their marquee free agent of the offseason. So this is the first season where you kind of look at it being, okay, you know, again, I don't know if they were intentionally bad. It just sort of happened by not signing anybody that they wanted to sign. I mean, there are a lot of good players they thought they were going to sign. They got absolutely none of them. So Ron Mercer became the second player. 2001-2002 is an interesting year because now we're getting into a different sort of era of the Baby Bulls and an era that I love because it was like, cool, I'm getting it on the ground floor. Elton Brand, who's still super young, I mean, he's, what, 2 years removed from being the number one pick. He's traded for Tyson Chandler, who's, you know, an untested, you know, largely unknown 18-year-old out of high school, but had all this raw ability and raw talent that everybody kind of went gaga over. They drafted Eddie Curry, who was a local Chicago kid that you know, had the body type that, you know, big bulking center that you assumed, okay, this guy is just going to dominate the league, you know, back to the basket. He's going to be great. This is a weird blend of a team because I remember when this team happened and it was very weird because you have these 18-year-olds and you have, you know, Curry and Chandler who are both out of high school. And then you sign Greg Anthony and Charles Oakley, or you acquire Greg Anthony and you sign Charles Oakley, or I trade, or I don't remember how they got Charles Oakley, but you have like 38-year-old or 39-year-old Charles Oakley running around. You have Greg Anthony. So those are the only two players over 30. You also at this, you know, at some point during the season, you add Jalen Rose to the mix and Jalen loved this opportunity because he shot at least 20 times a game. And just, that was his goal. He was like, cool. Nobody's going to care if I shoot all the time. And this was another year where they didn't want to be good. It was a sense of, you know what, hey, it's okay if we're not that bad. You know, if we're bad, because a lot of the big reasons was get that next draft. And there was a few guys in that next draft, the 2002-2003 draft. The guy they eventually got was Jay Williams, but there's some quotes in an SI article I found that really kind of alludes to the fact that the Bulls really knew that the 01-02 season was nothing. I mean, the signing Jalen Rose and telling him shoot at will was kind of a way of saying we don't really want to win. Here's the quote here. It says, will the 2001-2002 season become a throwaway campaign for the Bulls, designed to get Curry and Chandler some playing time and the franchise a shot at Duke point guard Jason Williams in next year's draft? Ultimately, that could be the pressure release that Tim Floyd, the head coach, and Chicago need. So, of course, they got the guy they wanted. They got Jay Williams. Of course, there were issues with him, but, you know, looking at this era of the Baby Bulls, it took a while. It took the drafts of Ben Gore and the drafts of Kirk Heinrich, as I mentioned, Scott Skiles becoming a coach, you know, to really get them into the playoffs and get them to be a team that were at least something, that at least had a pulse. But they had a ton of early first-round picks in this first little era, and this was sort of their goal was to accumulate all these picks over time and then eventually just get it going and become a good team. But, I mean, you look at their picks. This is between 1998 and 2002. Both first-round picks. We have Elton Brand first overall. Marcus Fizer, who was fourth overall and looked to have a bunch of raw talent and just never really worked out. Chris Mim, who was promptly traded for Jamal Crawford. Eddie Curry, who was the fourth overall pick. And then Jay Williams, who was the second overall pick. So they accumulated a lot of this talent, but, you know, you can tell there's a few guys in there that it just didn't really go together. But they're always a team that I remember because growing up as a kid, you know, becoming a basketball fan at that time and really becoming a hardcore basketball fan at that time, I love going to games because they were so cheap. I mean, my school would literally give away tickets. If you just went there, or if you had perfect attendance or you did something, they would just hand you Bulls tickets. Like, you could just show up, you know, the day of the game and get, you know, $5 or $10 Bulls tickets or whatever. And they still had good crowds at the time because there was still the aura of I'm going to see the Chicago Bulls. But that's why I always have a fondness in my heart for that team, is because I watched them. I watched the Ronald Dupree era, you know, Bulls and just these really, really terrible teams that I don't know. They're an interesting case of, would you consider it tanking or would you consider it just being bad to be bad? You know, I think there's difference.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider it more in the the rebuilding as opposed to throwing games type of tanking.
Right.
But they did. I mean, that stretch of badness, those 3 years from 2000 to 2002, where they won 17, 15, and 21 games, is is among the worst three game stretches of all time. Like, that's a pretty remarkable stretch of badness there. I mean, it's not quite the worst, but it is among those. Yeah, my guess is that Tim Floyd was not a very good coach.
That is breaking news. Yes, Tim Floyd, and also the man who replaced him, Bill Cartwright, also not very good. So,
yeah,
breaking new ground here. Yeah, Tim Floyd. No,
he lasted another season. I forgot about that.
Oh, Bill Cartwright.
Oh, yeah, and then the beginning of the 2004 season. That's right. They replaced him with Scott Skiles.
Yes, right.
They didn't get good till 2005. That was that's right. That was the year.
That was that weird. Yeah, that was the year where they weren't good at the beginning of the year, and then all of a sudden, something clicked in, and that happens with Scott Skiles teams. Teams buy into his kind of defense and yelling and him being a giant red ass or whatever, and especially that team, which was made up of a lot of really good, hard, smart sort of college players, guys like Ben Gordon, a Luol Deng, a Kirk Heinrich, like guys with good college pedigrees. So yeah, a red ass coach that's screaming at him really clicked for a lot of the guys. Didn't click for Tyson Chandler. It was many, many years removed from the Bulls until Tyson Chandler finally got it. And he remarks that he just hated Scott Skiles. And Eddie Curry, one of my favorite quotes of Scott Skiles ever, and how you can tell that teams kind of get sick of him when he's their coach. There's a quote about Eddie Curry, and at one point a Chicago reporter, because Eddie Curry was never a good rebounder ever, and for being his size and his strength and his footprint on the basketball court, you assumed he'd be good. So a coach asked him, or a reporter asked Skiles, how could he get more rebounds, and Skiles said, jump. Was his response. I remember that just being great. It's like, yeah, I could see why teams really just kind of don't listen to you after like 2 years. Like, it happened with the Bucks too. Like, the Bucks did the same thing where everybody bought in, then everyone's like, fuck this guy, we're sick of him or whatever. Like, it happens with Skiles and quotes like that. And Tyson Chandler has an article that he I don't know if he wrote, but he gave quotes to a few years ago where he talked about how Skiles just lit into him at Constant. So it was kind of the younger college guys that bought into Skiles' system that when they finally started finally getting kind of good.
Yeah, so they had Antonio Davis too. He was actually really good.
Yes. Yeah. He was they had, it was an interesting roster because they never, and that's why I always say they never fully were just super, super young. I mean, there was that one year where, there was nobody over 30, but they always sort of blended it in with a fewer older guys and veterans and guys that they'd always hope would sort of calm the locker room or whatever. You have a guy like Antonio Davis, like a Charles Oakley, a Scottie Pippen they brought back for a year. There's a lot of examples of that.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I think that's like a double-edged sword sometimes. I mean, Antonio Davis was good because he was, good leader and he still played well. It's interesting because Deng, Duhon, Gordon, and Nocioni were all rookies that year. That's four pretty good players to get in.
Oh, one. Yeah.
I mean, Duhon had a couple of good years and Nocioni was pretty good for a while. And of course, and Gordon was real good for his, first 3-4 years. And Deng's, a good player, obviously. I mean, I guess it seemed more impressive when they were young because not all of them ended up having, several of them faded out. But still at the time, that was a pretty good group of young players. Plus you had Heinrich as the second year guy. So, I do think that sometimes you talk about like that veteran influence being a positive thing, and it definitely can be, but there's also I was kind of thinking of a couple of months ago when there was sort of like that, when there was like the discussion of like Carmelo Anthony and Tim Hardaway Jr. getting into a fight or something like on the Knicks. And there was just like a bunch of like dysfunction there. And I was just kind of thinking like, that's one advantage to an approach that the 76ers basically have, of basically only having young players for the most part. They have Jason Richardson, but he's not, he's obviously not playing. He's been hurt. And Malamute, who's, basically been a role player his entire career, but they don't have like a veteran name or anything, but on one hand, like you do worry about it's probably good to have some veterans in there to give you an example of how to play and blah, blah. You can see the value in that. But at the same time, like those veterans still have egos. They still want to play. They still are probably better than the young players in a lot of respects, and the coaches tend to want to play the veterans over the young players. And if they don't, then you have a threat of a toxic locker room, or at least issues there. I mean, you know, there's, I do think, like, you know, the veterans in, you know, in theory, it's nice and it does work sometimes, but it also can, like, be a bad situation too if you don't, I guess, if you just don't have the right veterans.
Yeah, absolutely. And the example that I brought up about Jalen Rose of just, you know, being a total chucker when he was right on the Bulls might be a situation like that where he was like, cool, I'm just going to put up a bunch of numbers and not really care about, you know, doing anything but that. And that's what he was. I mean, he was not pat. I mean, I remember watching those games. It was ISO Jalen Rose pretty much the entire game. And I don't know how much Jamal Crawford learned by watching, you know, Jalen Rose ISO people, but, you know.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I guess it did work. Yeah. Kind of actually, you know what? Never mind. I take that back. He goes, you know what? I'm just going to come in off the bench. You know, he learned that he could do it off the bench. So I don't have to start. I'll come in, and then, yeah, I'll just dribble around a lot and then take a shot. And a lot of times it'll go in. So
I always like,
I'll give him that. Yeah.
Yeah. Jamal Crawford is my favorite player who isn't really actually that good, but is just really fun to watch. Yeah. Like, I was
it's
so
smart of him to realize, I credit to him of saying, you know what? Yeah, I'll come off the bench. Screw it. I mean, who cares if I start? I'm just going to be able to, because he doesn't have to do anything. Yeah. You know, like, when he comes off the bench, no one's gonna care that he just comes in and chucks. I mean, he's not really very good, but
I mean, he figured out the perfect role for him, and it fits his skill set and all that. I mean, either he's perfectly fine at what he does, but yeah, I mean, he's just like, I was really glad when he was on the Hawks for a few years, because he was fun to watch, you know.
Absolutely.
He doesn't really, like I said, he has all these flaws as a player, but he just is really, he's a really fun one-on-one player to watch. So so good for him. So anything else on the on your Bulls?
No, that's it for the baby Bulls, unfortunately.
All right, well, I am going to talk about a team that I always bring up, or pretty much always bring up on this show, the 2004-2005 Hawks, who were built around new additions. Antoine Walker, who had just come from a season of missing more three-pointers than anybody else in history, I believe, in Dallas. And Al Harrington, who they had picked up from the Pacers. I think they traded Steven Jackson for him to the Pacers. And Al Harrington was 24, so he was kind of a young up-and-comer. You know, still kind of unclear what his career path would end up being.
I'd imagine that trade went really well for the Pacers. I'm guessing multiple, you know, Eastern Conference Finals appearances and possibly, you know.
Well, it went okay for a little while, and then there may have been a few issues there.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, but I'll have to look it up at some point.
Some malice involved.
At
some venue that it rhymes.
As we're saying that, I'm looking at the ESPN thing scrolled in Detroit. And Indiana just scrolled up on my screen.
Oh, nice. There you go.
That is very odd. Yeah, so there you go.
There you go.
I'm imagining Roy Hibbert did not punch Jonas Valanciunas or Jonas Jerebko today, but I don't know that. I cannot confirm nor deny that they had a gigantic brawl in today's NBA game.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, that would be quite – we probably would have been talking about that if that were the case. But so they had Josh Childress, Josh Smith, and Royale Ivy as their big rookies. And Boris Diaw was in his second year. He was used as a point guard by Mike Woodson, because Mike Woodson didn't really know what to make of Boris Diaw. And in fairness, like – it was kind of hard to see, like, you know, the game was changing, you know, so it was kind of a little bit hard to see what you could do with Boris Diaw, because he just was totally unwilling to shoot and was, you know, he could pass. That, you know, was a great skill, but it was really hard to find. It was hard, at least in this team, to find a good role for him, but then get a good coach like Mike D'Antoni. And yeah, you find a great role for him. So,
yeah. I remember him being a total, and even when the Suns got him, I remember being a laughable player that people just didn't understand, you know, what he was capable of. And credit to D'Antoni to really figuring out, yeah, look, this is the best, you know, because he used him so, so well. And yeah, you really have to go back and look. We take it for granted knowing what Diaw is now, but you really take for granted what he, you know, was then, which was nothing. He was a weird, weird, weird player at that time.
Yeah. So they had, and they brought in Kenny Anderson, who of course was a Georgia Tech star and one of the great college point guards of all time. I guess really high school point guards. He was really hyped, as you know, and ended up having, you know, good but not great NBA career. Kevin Willis, who had been a Hawk star in the 80s, was 42 at this point and still playing, still played for a couple more years, actually. And also John Barry, who had played Georgia Tech as well, who would be traded fairly soon into the season for my favorite Hawk of the season, Tyron Liu, who basically was the only was one of the very few things of joy into the season. I mean,
that's not good.
There was just the like
that should not happen.
Right. I mean,
if Tyron Liu is a source of joy or one of your top sources of joy, that's
right.
That's probably
right. And they were 13-69. They were terrible. This was I had just moved to Atlanta in 2004. So, I just kind of was like, oh, I'd like to pick a team here to like, and to root for. And cause I like sports. So right. I ended up picking the Hawks and learned about the Hawks and then kind of there sort of created my, NBA obsession that I continue today. So, you know, what a team to inspire that, of course, a terrible, terrible team.
Ever watch another NBA game.
Right. Again, but. The first game that I went to, in fact, was a game against your Bulls that year, and they lost by like 40 at home. So and Eddie Curry was just like awesome in that game. He had like
that, I think that was the really good Eddie Curry year, right?
I believe so. Yes,
because there was one year where he led the NBA in field goal percentage. And it was just like, aha, I finally figured it out. And then he regressed and then he got traded away and all that good stuff. Right. But yeah, I remember there being that one Eddie Curry year where it was like, oh, my God, like this is what we wanted. And then, yeah, that. Short-lived, but yeah, that sounds about right. So
yeah, so it was just they ended the season with just some sort of like in I'm looking it up here because I'm trying to remember. They went 1-27 from February 10th to April 8th. They did beat the 2005 Timberwolves, so
oh there you go. So
yeah, so yeah, I mean, it was exciting to see Josh Smith initially because we didn't know what was to come with the long twos, and I don't think we would have understand how bad long twos were even, you know, in this is 2005 still, so it's not quite, you know, the analytics aren't quite there, the, you know, understanding of spacing and all that, at least not like on a like team fan level.
Right, right. This is still when Allen Iverson is still being, you know, considered one of the best. I mean, he lived and died by long twos for the most part.
Sure.
And nobody cared. I mean, it was fine. Yeah.
It's a different game. Yeah, that stuff wasn't as well understood.
Him dribbling around, deking a few guys, and then taking a 17-footer was like, ah, sweet. Right.
Yeah, and I mean, he was 19, too. So, I mean, he dunked, and he could block shots, and it was cool. So, yeah, that's totally, and that was totally fine. I like Josh Childress a lot. He had the cool fro, and he actually was a pretty good player for a while, and then went to Greece, and then just completely fell off when he came back. But so, you know, I have some fond memories of following the team. And then, you know, they weren't really very good for the next few years either. There was kind of the fiasco of trying to get Joe Johnson over in the offseason. They ended up doing a sign and trade with Phoenix, even though Phoenix likely would not have matched because Joe was a restricted free agent. They ended up giving up two draft picks in there. One that turned out to be Rajon Rondo, and the other that turned out to be Robin Lopez. That very, very came close to having the Hawks end up losing out on Al Horford. So,
yeah. Well, thankfully, the Suns also screwed up those picks, too, so you don't have to worry.
Well, that's true.
So you take some solace in the fact that the Suns also screwed those picks up.
Yeah. So, and then also in that offseason, they drafted Marvin Williams instead of Chris Paul, which I don't really want to talk about. But
it happens to the best of us.
Marvin Williams was fine.
At the time, I thought Marvin was going to be pretty sweet. I could have been dumb, but I thought he was going to be pretty good.
I do think there were a lot of people who thought, oh, Marvin Williams is going to be an awesome talent, and he's the pick that you go with there. You know, even though they need a point guard, I think like that was a defensible position at the time, and then, you know, and then didn't look good. And then
getting that killer two or three guard was a big deal. I mean, that was right. I mean, yeah, I totally defensible. I get it. Yeah. In hindsight now, but at the time, I remember Marvin Williams, you know, 6'7", North Carolina product. you know, really good body, crazy athleticism. Like, that was fine. I mean, at the time, it wasn't a complete – that I remember, it wasn't a complete, like, oh, my God, what a failed pick or whatever. It was – sure. Yeah, it was what it was. But sure. Now in hindsight, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Paul just ended up being insane. And people thought he might be People thought he might be too short for the NBA. And they had a chance at Darren Williams was the other guy who was like, yeah, you know, so they had a chance at one of those guys and didn't get it. So, it took them a while to get good. They had two, like, mid-20s win seasons. Finally, the 08 season when they did draft Horford. They were 37-45, but they ended up going seven games with the Celtics that in the playoffs. I went to one of those games. I think it was game four. It might have been game three. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I've been to two playoff games. So I went to one of the Cavs. I went to the last home playoff game that LeBron won. In Cleveland, I believe that.
Oh, okay.
Is the last game that I went to. That series didn't go well after that. But it's cool because after they got Horford, they have been and still are a playoff team every year, even though the maximum they've been to is in the second round. They haven't necessarily had great showings in the playoffs and they're never really been considered a contender, although I think they've kind of been like on the edge of like if something happened they could have gone further and maybe even made it in the finals. I mean it would have been an unlikely scenario but not impossible, but I think I value the success that they have been having, and especially this year, you know, being on pace for 60 wins with Horford, the only player left from that era of Hawks basketball when I was there watching, when I lived in Atlanta, was there watching them every day. I value that even if they have had an 8-year run of being in the playoffs and being pretty good and being pretty fun. And now adding on top of this great season, however it turns out, however the rest of the season goes and the playoffs go, I really value a lot like how exciting and how fun they've been and how just what a joy they are to watch. And and we're separated, from 10 years from this team and a lot of things have happened, a lot of regime changes, but it is, I can feel that link to that time. And so that's part of my sentimental attachment to that the first team that absolutely. I followed very closely.
It pays, and that's what happened with me. Sort of when the Bulls were back in the playoffs with Derrick Rose and Thibs, and all those guys and Noah's and those sort of guys is that you go through. I mean, and that's why I like bad teams. That's why I like kind of following sometimes. I don't mind if my team's bad because then it's that much more rewarding when they're good again. You know what I mean? You live through the bad, you watch the bad, and you sort of saw the build. It's a slow build a lot of times, but you see it, what's kind of the idea there and why, how you get from point A to point B. And that's exciting for me. And it's the same way in baseball. I love like prospects or bad teams and building up through the farm system and that sort of stuff. It's not much different in basketball too. I enjoy having, I think it would get boring to have a team that was just perpetually good. I like having a really bad team every so often and maybe even a 2-year run of a bad team to see them build to that point and get to that point B. But yeah, no, I absolutely, there's no reason for you not to be sentimental. It's a great season by the Hawks.
Yeah, and you you still have Kirk Heinrich from those years, so.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, I do. I know.
I know, like, people, like, Kirk Heinrich is kind of the, he gets a beating from all the Bulls fans on Twitter. And
he's
you
not
know.
Good.
Well, yeah, so but, he's your link to that.
I mean, oh, he went away, though. He went away, and they were good, and then he comes back, and now they're not as good. Yeah. I'm blaming it solely on him. But, no, it was fine.
He played for the Hawks for a year. Yeah,
I know. We were perfectly okay without him. I don't know why.
He was okay for us. I didn't mind him. But
he was fine.
That was
five
years ago now, so,
Yeah, he's gotten much, much worse than he was 5 years ago, so
yeah,
I will tell you that.
True.
But yeah, I got Kirk Heinrich still, so there you go. Yay.
All right, well, we'll take a little break and talk about a few of our other favorite worst team ever tanking stories. All right, and we're back, and we are talking about a few of our other favorite or notable tanking teams. You know, one that's, of course, brought up a lot are both the 97 Spurs and the 97 Celtics, who were the kind of the favorites to get Tim Duncan in the 97 draft, of course. That worked out pretty well for San Antonio, and not as well for the Celtics, who were the first franchise ever. Now, you know, one thing I have to say about that whole situation is there are Celtics fans, you know, like obviously the Celtics had, you know, they have a Len Bias, they had the Len Bias tragedy, they had the Reggie Lewis tragedy, which of course were human tragedies, but also set back the franchise, and you know, you can kind of understand at both levels. I feel like this 97 Celtics thing, it's like Celtics people need to kind of get over that one, because like teams are really bad and they lose in the lottery every year. Like every team does right. That like you're this team isn't special because they missed out on the Tim Duncan lottery. Like that's just like some weird, but that's like a Celtic like arrogance of wanting, thinking you should always be great and everything should be
right, exactly.
Kind of feeling. That's the way it speaks to me as a fan of a team with less historic success. Plus, like the Celtics had some pretty good teams between the, you know, like, but yeah, they had like a drought of that championship, that 15-year drought or whatever, or 20-year drought, I guess. But you know, they had a couple of good teams here and there, so it's not like it was.
Yeah, by 98, like, 99, they were already okay.
Yeah,
you know,
they had a conference finals appearance with Walker and Pierce, and then, you know, so it wasn't like it was some like huge, like, you know, like massive thing where they were terrible for 20 years.
Right.
You know, they had some down years, but they had some good years too. So calm down, Celtics fans.
So shut up.
Yeah.
1997.
I'm shaking my fist right now. You can't see it because this is a podcast, but you know, getting that's about as hot of a take as I'm going to get. So I don't know. Not much else there. Obviously the Spurs were bad because David Robinson was hurt pretty much the entire year. That was Popovich took over for Bob Hill, which gets people. Apparently they have weird feelings about that, even though I think Popovich turned out pretty well there. That was also the Dominique Wilkins year for the Spurs.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They had Will Perdue as well. And Vinny Del Negro. So yeah, they were a pretty old team by then. They like almost everyone, like all of their top seven players were older than 30 as far as minutes go.
Yeah, and that was a team where, again, I don't blame them. I mean, you have David Robinson get hurt, and it's like, all right, well, you know, what are we doing here? Who cares? You know, at this point, who cares? And yeah, they're a one that, yeah, there's some issues with how, you know, bad, but they were just going to be bad regardless, I think. They're one that I'm not really too upset about. That's one in history that worked out perfectly well, and people sort of look at and use it as an example, but, I mean, that team was going to be no good anyway, so it's whatever.
Yeah, I mean, looking at their record, I mean, they were one game worse than the Nuggets and two game worse than the Sixers, and they weren't really that close to anybody else. So, I mean, you know, I guess they could have, in theory, tanked some games to do that. But it wasn't like they were, you know, the Celtics and the Grizzlies had the two worst records. I don't think the Grizzlies could get the number one pick that year. I think they were, like, ineligible for it for a while, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. I'm always curious on this year and the whole Pop run of how the hell he got to become the general manager of the team with like no front office experience whatsoever.
That's
like,
interesting.
I never understood that. Like it always confused me when I was like, when they said, well, he was general manager and then he became a head coach. And I'm like, oh, huh. Okay. And then like, I look at his history and it's like, yeah, he was assistant here and assistant here. And then he was hired as general manager. I'm like, what? Like this guy who really was just kind of a no name assistant becomes the vice president and general manager of basketball operations. Granted, it absolutely worked, but I never understood how he got there. Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a long story somewhere or who he wowed or what he did, but it's very weird.
Yeah. I mean, he has a relationship with Larry Brown. So he was Larry Brown's assistant with the Spurs and
that's really it, though. And then he was
and then he returned there once Peter Holt purchased the team. So he must have had a relationship with Peter Holt. I mean, presumably. So yeah, I guess just from being the assistant, that is interesting. That's
it's just a weird career path. I mean, usually those guys that do, I mean, you get guys in history that do that, but a lot of times they're, you know, legendarily historic players or whatever, and their franchise that was with them or whatever. I mean, we see examples like that where those guys become GMs or whatever, but usually they have some front office. They don't go from assistant to, you know, no-name assistant, like a just absolute no-name assistant to general manager, and then this general manager has enough power to fire his coach and become the head coach himself. It's very weird. It all obviously worked out great, but yeah, it's a very odd situation. I just don't get it. It's very weird, but all right.
Yeah.
It worked, so I'm not going to get mad. So
yeah. Well, I'm glad you're not getting mad. You should get even.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to become an assistant
manager. I hear it's better to get even than to get mad.
Okay. I like that.
All right. So, who's next?
All right. One team that I wanted to put in here, and I'm not going to go into a ton of details about this. It's the 2002-2003 Cavaliers. And this was a deliberate attempt to kind of field a bad team to get into the lottery and to get, you know, LeBron James. And obviously that all happened and it all worked out very well for the time for Cleveland. And in the long run, I believe it absolutely did work out well for Cleveland. But this wasn't a team that I think, you know, outwardly was tanking, but a lot of the moves they did at the beginning of the year sort of led them to say, hey, you know what, look, it'll be better if we're not very good this year. I mean, they traded Andre Miller, who had led the league in assists the prior year. I traded him for Darius Miles, which is always a really good thing when you can acquire Darius Miles. It's always a good thing. Wesley Person was traded for, at the time, a guy that was just an absolute nobody, Matt Barnes. Huge minutes were given to Ricky Davis, which is usually a good recipe for not winning. And then rookie Carlos Boozer obviously got a ton of minutes, which is fine. That was okay, and that worked out. But, yeah, basically the – you look at the Andre Miller trade and Wesley Person. I mean, those are the two best players on their previous team that were just sent away for guys that were lesser and really nothing players at that point. I mean, Darius Miles was fun to watch, but not a good player. And Matt Barnes was an absolute nothing. So that team in the end, they finished, you know, bottom four in the league in points per game, offensive rating, defensive rating, opponent points per game. I mean, it was just not a very good year at all. You know, they started at 8-34, so they weren't very good. Coach John Lucas was fired. He was replaced by Keith Smart, who's always very good as well if you want to lose a lot of games. And he got them to a 9-31 record at the end. So he was just as bad. So that was very good. At the end of the year, there's a few quotes here from an ESPN article. Lucas, he said that Cleveland Cavaliers owner Gordon Gund had purposefully traded away players who could contribute in order to foster a losing record, draft LeBron James, and increase the value of the franchise before selling them. He eventually did sell the team. Ricky Davis agreed as well that the team was kind of essentially there to lose, and him getting a lot of minutes was probably the reason why he thought that. He was kind of looked himself in the mirror and said, guys, I'm not very good. Why you keep playing me? Like, I think this was the year too where he gave himself the triple-double, right?
I believe that was the year, yeah. Yes. It definitely was. It was before LeBron came, so it would have been either this year or the year before. So
yeah, right. So, but that's funny that Ricky Davis, the guy who was one of the top players on the team, was like, "Yeah, we probably were trying to lose a lot," which that's always pretty good. So that's a team right there, and it all obviously worked out for them pretty well. But yeah, this is a team that not necessarily tanking, but I guess you can sort of purposely losing at the beginning of the year is a good way to put that.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think they're not that different from what. You know, the Sixers are doing now other than a better player, you know, or
yeah. And like, honestly, an Andre Miller, players. Wesley Person Cavs team wasn't probably going to make a playoff run either.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to me, those are situations where I get it. I absolutely think that's the right idea is you look in the mirror and go, okay, what are we going to do with this core? Yeah, we can win, you know, 35 games and sneak into the eighth seed or whatever in the East, or screw it. Let's lose a lot of games and try to get LeBron James. Well,
and I mean, LeBron is not just a basketball difference, but a difference
exactly
tied to Cleveland and as well. You know, that was obviously a great fortune for the Cavs. I think it's sort of an interesting mix of guys who that team had, and even like the first LeBron team, like they got rid of Darius Miles and they got rid of Ricky Davis about as quickly as you possibly could. They also got rid of Carlos Boozer, but they didn't mean to do that one. That was an accident.
Whoops.
Whoops. Hey,
Piece of paper. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I did not know that Jason Capono was a rookie the same year with the Cavs as LeBron was.
Yeah. LeBron unfortunately overshadowed the Jason Capono run to the
He got 427 minutes. I mean, that is about a sixth to the amount that LeBron got. So
remember Jason Capono was a really big deal for that one year. a really big deal. Like it was like 2 years where he was like one of the most valuable players. You know, this guy was just a knockdown, amazing. Yeah. And then
maybe one of the most valuable players might be overstretching it, but yeah,
no, that's a little. I wanted to qualify that a little bit, but a guy that was
Then he started doing like a weird like taking long twos thing.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, dude.
You understand
it out, and then you lost it. Like,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, right. Man, weird.
Yeah.
Must have got advice from Josh Smith on the old figure it out and then do the exact opposite of what figure it out means.
Exactly. One of my favorites, I would say, is the Mark Madsen game for the 2005-2006 Timberwolves, who basically it came down to one game that Minnesota had to lose to keep its draft pick. So even though Mark Madsen had not taken a three-pointer in 135 games, he managed to take 7 shots in 9 minutes. Finished 0 for 7 from behind the arc. I think you put down here that he had a negative 8.8 game score. And basically he explained it later, and I'm a little confused by his explanation, I guess. How do you interpret this?
He's full of shit.
Okay.
Another thing too to look at, I did a little bit more number crunching of this game or whatever. 25% of his total field goals that entire year were taken in this game. So
there you go.
He shot, I think, 15 times in the game.
Yeah.
So, 25% of his total field goal attempts in the entire season were taken in this game. So, yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. Mark. Yeah. The crowd yelling shoot made you shoot. Okay.
Well, he said, like, I thought, like, I didn't think he was saying it more in this game. It was more like he had been, like he'd been working on it. So he was given this chance and he was trying to do his best in the game. I guess it's what he's saying. I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't really get his incentive to go out there. And I mean, I certainly don't think he was like purposely missing them, you know, but
no. I think they sort of, in a lot of ways, said, "Hey, you're not very good. Why don't you take all of our shots today?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, whatever." I mean, like, to him, he's probably thinking in his head, and this is the confidence that players have, and that's everybody. Even a Mark Madsen is probably this way too, where to get in the NBA, you have to know that you're, you know, one of the greatest basketball players in the world or whatever. I'm sure Mark Madsen thought when they said, "Hey, Mark, let's focus through you. Let's have you be the focal point of this game." I'm sure he didn't go, "Yeah, you know, you just want me to miss every shot." I'm sure he said, "Hey, I'm going to go score 40 tonight," or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I absolutely agree that he didn't intentionally try to go out there and miss shots. I just think he's not very good. And when you filter the ball through Mark Madsen and he shoots 15 times a game, things happen.
Yeah. Well, he has more rings than I do.
That's true. He's got a lot more rings than all of us. So. What does he have now? What's his ring count?
Was he on?
I don't remember if he tagged along and got another one.
Well, I thought he was just
his
3.
Assistant. Does he get any as an assistant? When did he become a Lakers assistant? I don't remember.
Well, that's what the internet's for.
Yeah,
I'll
good thing.
Look it up.
What did podcasts do before the internet, Jason?
It's very confusing.
How did they look up things?
I don't know. It's hard to say.
Where they recorded a podcast on their cassette and then just went around to people's houses to give them the cassette and annoy them.
I guess that was back when they had the radio.
What?
I mean, the radio may still exist now, but, you know, it's not. I don't know. It doesn't have assistant coaching record on Basketball Reference. So,
okay. Unfortunately, what the hell?
Yeah.
2013 to the present. So I don't know.
Yeah, they won their last title in 2010. So,
yeah. So, no, he was prior. So, okay.
All right.
Just 3.
There you go. So sad they didn't get any more rings, I guess. I don't know. It's not really that sad, but
no, it's all right.
So I guess the most recent example of like some fishiness going on in late season would be the 2012 Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, so you have the 2012 Golden State Warriors, and they had a first-round draft pick that was owed to the Utah Jazz, but the caveat was it was protected. So it was, you know, if we're at an X amount of, you know, place in the standings, we get to keep the pick. If we're not, you know, they get the pick or whatever. And something sort of clicked in the Warriors front office where they went, we're going to have to give up this pick. I don't know if that's necessarily what it is, but I'll present the evidence, and you can kind of think what you say there. So anyway, midseason, there's a lot of changes in Warriors land. They traded Monta Ellis for Andrew Bogut, which, okay, not a bad trade, except for Bogut was out for the year and wasn't going to play, so not really necessarily the greatest thing, a move for the future, that one was. They also strategically kind of shut down a lot of the really good players for these kind of weird injuries that nobody knew existed. David Lee got shut down, despite, you know, averaging 20-10 at the time, or at least being a really good, you know, a guy that could at least get you, you know, X amount of points and at least a double-double. It was a guy that definitely averaging a double-double. Steph Curry, who was still a very young player at that point, he was shut down. A lot of weird stuff here. What I basically, here's their starting lineup on opening night, and here's the starting lineup they trotted out their last game of the year to kind of give you an idea of the roster turnover and the guys that sat out the end of the year. Starting lineup on opening night was Monta Ellis, David Lee, Steph Curry, Darrell Wright, and Andres Beidrit, which is not a bad team. That's a pretty decent team. Starting lineup for the final night, and if you know who half these guys are, more credit to you. Chris Wright was their starting point guard. Are you aware of Chris Wright?
I have a friend named Chris Wright, but probably not the same guy.
Was it him?
No.
Can you confirm that it was him?
It was not the same guy.
What is your Chris Wright?
Chris Wright? He's a guy. Friend's a little strong. He's a guy I knew in high school, I guess.
Okay. Well, so you don't know then. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm 99% sure it was not the same Chris Wright.
Okay. Well, fair enough.
I vaguely remember the basketball Chris Wright, but not particularly well.
Yeah, I think he had like dreadlocks, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong. But Jeremy Tyler, Michael Gladness. I don't know who Michael Gladness is at all. Clay Thompson. So that worked out. He was still a young player at this point.
I know him, yes.
Yes, I've you probably heard of him. Charles Jenkins. I know this Warriors team is awful. I know. Okay. And then the bench. They only played seven guys this entire game. The bench consisted of Mikey Moore, who got 25 plus minutes, and then Dominic McGuire, who also got 25 plus minutes. So, that's shockingly, their pick did not go to the Utah Jazz, and they were able to draft Harrison Barnes with that pick. So, it worked out that all these guys got hurt, and Monta Ellis got traded for a guy that wasn't going to play. It worked out very well for them. So, yeah. There you go. And there was obviously, at the time too, if people are familiar, there was a lot of like, okay, guys. Like, it was pretty transparent what they were doing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
If you remember this wasn't like a, what's going on? And, you know, it was kind of, this team is intentionally trying to lose, to not lose their pick. So, and they did. And they, Mikey Moore got 25 minutes, I think, for the last like half of the year. So there you go.
Oh, good for Mikey. You know, get those minutes, you know, get those, you know, he's got to get his work in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think he did too much
more. Be like Mikey Moore. That's what I always say.
I've always subscribed to that. Yeah. And it's always worked out well. I got his autograph when I was a kid because I went to like a Clippers game, and Elton Brand was very nice about signing autographs. This is when I was young and actually still cared about autographs. I don't, obviously don't care much anymore. But so then like the rest of the Clippers ran through, and then Mikey Moore just stayed for like 20 minutes after because like what else does Mikey Moore have to do? Like, he doesn't even hear the team meeting. So he just kind of stayed around and signed everyone's autographs. So that was very nice of him, but yeah.
Yeah, well, good for him.
Also, the last year of Mikey Moore. He was never again seen in the NBA, unfortunately.
That's too bad. I feel like Mikey Moore might have played for the Hawks for a little bit.
2002, 2003 for five games.
Oh, no.
I
was thinking later. Okay, never mind.
Okay. Let me see anymore. Nope.
No, he did not. Okay.
Oh, dear God. There was a year in Sacramento where he started 79 games.
Wow.
Good God.
There was one year where he actually was pretty good, I think.
Yeah, it was the year prior, New Jersey. He almost averaged 10 points a game.
Okay, there you go.
The 07 New Jersey, and then Sacramento signed him and said, you play all the time, and you'll be good. And he was like, I'm not good.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm really not good. I'm
Sacramento's
still
made a lot of bad decisions over the
years.
Yes.
Yeah, they...
He did have
many steps forward without making a few steps back. So
he did have a 613 true shooting percentage. We'll give him that. But
you didn't think we were going to talk about Mikey Moore, did you today?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're just all over the place. Matt Fremwright at Chicken Noodle Hoop has a great post that he shared with us on what he calls the Bobcatters and near Bobcatters. And Bobcatting is when you finish with the worst in offense efficiency and defensive efficiency in the league in the same year. So the three Bobcatters are the 87 Los Angeles Clippers, the 93 Dallas Mavericks, and of course the 2012 Charlotte Bobcats, who are, who of course, winning percentage-wise, that was the lockout year, but winning percentage-wise have the worst winning percentage of all time. 759 was their record. So this leads to me doing an aside that made me upset as I was doing the dishes earlier today. You know, last year, the Charlotte franchise had never had a second-round appearance in the playoffs in its history. But now this year they do, because they got the history from the Old Charlotte Hornets.
Oh, that's cheap.
That's a little bit upsetting.
That is weird. Yeah. I don't like that.
I don't like it either.
I always get weird out by that. That's not the same franchise.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
It's just not. I mean, there's you can't do that. There's too many ties to the old. I mean, that's garbage.
It's wrong. Yeah,
I didn't know that. I forgot they did that. I didn't know they did that.
I knew that they did that, but the full weight and consequences of that decision did not really necessarily hit me.
Hornets have any the original Hornets? Did they ever win the division? Like, do they hang a banner now of like a franchise that doesn't even like?
I don't
know if they ever did. I doubt it.
I don't think they would have won the division. No, I don't. I don't know the
because that'd be ridiculous. They had like a banner ceremony for like a team that had the same name of us did something like
that would be unfortunate. Yes, I would be against it. Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay, I didn't think so, but
we'll solve that mystery later. But so yeah, there were some good ones here. One thing that I thought was let's see. There was one team that I thought that was very interesting. Like the 1980 Detroit Pistons, I thought that who won 16 games had Bob Lanier and Bob McAdoo on those teams. Like it's funny how bad they were with those. Like, I mean, I know although Lanier's and McAdoo still played quite a few seasons. But it's funny how, like, even though, like, you know, you have these good players, you can be so downright awful. I don't know. Were any of the other teams that we talked about a few of them already, the Bulls and the Hawks and a few of the other ones. Were there any there that stood out to you as worthy of mention?
Yeah, the 97 Grizzlies. But that I tend to the Grizzlies at that point are still a pretty young franchise. So I tend to have some issue with that. Calling them. I mean, they're. You know, them being a truly awful team or historically awful. I mean, I get it. They were still
expansion
a very young
teams
team
get a little bit of a break, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to let them slide on that one. I always forget how bad the 06 Portland Trailblazers were. That was one, because I always sort of think of the Trailblazers as just kind of being always okay. And this was obviously not a year where they were okay.
Yeah.
And this is just a franchise completely in transition and just a lot of issues at this point as well. And then, of course, a recent example, the 2010 Timberwolves. I always forgot how pretty terrible they were. So
even though they had
Al Jefferson. And they have a good team. Like, you look at it, you got Jefferson, you got Love, you got Corey Brewer's an okay guy, and they're not good at all. They're really, really bad. And like, you would at least, I get like defensively, but you can't even pull up a good offense with Al Jefferson and Kevin Love. Like, come on, like, really?
Well, Kevin Love was playing behind Ryan Hollins, so that was part of the problem.
Oh, yeah, that was still in that little era where remember that when that was an issue of like Kevin Love not starting enough games or
So. The Grizzlies, not to pick on them a little bit, but as far as like, I kind of looked a little bit at like the worst multi-year stretches ever, and they had 15, 14, 19, 8. Now, 8 was in the 99 lockout season, so it's obviously, it's that is down from what it would be because of the fewer games. 22, 23, and 23 over 7 seasons. So that's by far the worst stretch of, 23 or under that any team has ever had. I mean, most teams only have the most that they have of that kind of stretch is 3 seasons. The 98 to 2000 Clippers have a similar stretch. The 87 through 89 Clippers, the 92 through 94 Mavs, the Baby Bulls that we mentioned, the Warriors of 2000 to 2002 had a bad stretch. They did actually win. They won 4 more games than the Bulls did during those 3 seasons. And then the 92 through 95 Timberwolves had a 4 season stretch of 15, 19, 20, and 21 wins. So
yeah,
those are the worst multi-year, you know.
That Grizzlies run is pretty bad. Like, there is nothing there. I mean, that killed a franchise in a lot of ways, in terms really of, you know, the Vancouver Grizzlies. So it's pretty telling there. But, of course, now they're kind of a really good franchise and really stable. And it's good to see them come because, yeah, it was bad there for a while. I mean, that's a really bad stretch. I mean, we're talking about all-time bad stretches, and they stand out in that list. So.
And I also looked at the best players on the worst 82-game teams. This is going by win share. So the 73-76ers were John Block with 3.4. The 98 Nuggets, Anthony Goldwire with 3.0. The 93 Mavericks, Derek Harper with 2.7. The 94 Mavericks, Popeye Jones with 3.6.
That's probably not good. You probably shouldn't have Popeye Jones be your best player.
the 1987 Clippers, who won 12 games, had Michael Cage with 7.2.
Great year.
Yeah. Which
it's a really good year.
Yeah. The 2005 Hawks, Josh Childress with 4.6. The 97 Grizzlies with Greg Anthony, 3.5. And the 83 Rockets with Allen Level, 3.8. So. Now everybody knows
that Michael Cage year. That's pretty good. But yeah,
that's a pretty good year.
I thought there'd be some better names there. That's pretty telling how bad the name. I'm surprised there aren't more, you know, individual good years on a really bad team. It's pretty funny how there's just not. I mean, there's really none.
The 93 Mavericks, I think, are worth some special attention. They this is from the Bobcatting post. Their offense was the 10th worst ever. Their defense was the 10th worst ever. This was Jim Jackson's rookie year. He came in like the last couple of months during the season, helped them a little bit toward the end. Derek Harper was really their only other, you know, name player. They actually went 7-64 through their first 71 games, but they ended up, rallying a little bit, finishing 7-14, at the end of the season to avoid the, worst record ever. They, in fact, won against Seattle and Houston on the road, toward the end of the season. I'm sure Houston and Seattle were not really trying it too hard at that point, but still. So that was a, 10th worst ever for on offense and defense is a pretty impressive mark.
That is pretty good. Yeah, that is not bad. And in anticipation of this podcast, what I did, I put together kind of a spreadsheet looking at the worst team ever and who would really be the worst team ever. And this is not nearly, I mean, there's someone I'm sure much smarter that can do a much bigger study than this to look at it. But what I kind of looked at is I looked at Basketball Reference's simple rating system, the SRS. If you see that on team pages, really good rating. It just kind of takes into account a bunch of different things, offense, you know, defense, a bunch of stuff. You can
schedule,
look at baseball.
You know, yeah.
So, yeah, strength of schedule, all that sort of stuff. You can go to basketballreference.com for you know, complete explanation on what that is or whatever. So I looked at that and I looked at win-loss percentage. And of course, I'm sure there's numerous better ways to do this. You know, Matt did a really good job, you know, on his end of looking at, you know, offensive rating and defensive rating or whatever. I kind of want to look at the team that was the worst, you know, win-loss percentage and the worst at simple rating. And I kind of normalized that a little bit to make sure that, you know, we were talking about only these bottom 20 teams. And these are only teams that got under 20% total win percentage or whatever. So what I did is I looked at, I combined a normalized look at win-loss percentage and simple rating to try to get, you know, I kind of just add those numbers together to get who I thought was the worst team ever. And of course, bigger study for a different day, and I'd love to actually explore it a little bit more. But basically what my numbers came up with were the worst team ever. Maybe I'll do it. I'll build up the anticipation here. I'll do the bottom five. So we'll start with number five is the 87 Los Angeles Clippers, who, according to my number, had a negative 17. They had a really terrible what do we got here? We got a 14% win percentage and then a negative 11 simple rating system. So not very good whatsoever. The 98 Denver Nuggets come in at number four. It's a team that doesn't pop up too often for us. Yeah, they had a 13 win percentage and then a negative 11 simple rating, 11.7 simple rating.
Just for posterity's sake, yeah, they were 11-71, and they had their top minutes players were Dean Garrett, LaFonso Ellis, Anthony Goldwire, Johnny Newman, and Bobby Jackson.
There you go.
And then Danny Fortson. So. They had Tony Batty as well. So they had some guys who, you know, had some names, but
that's not bad. Yeah, it's not a bad roster. I mean, it's not a good team at all.
No. I mean, all those guys were like young and not productive yet.
Yeah, right, so. Right. All right, then you have, as I said, the 98 Nuggets, who might have LaFonso Ellis again in there. And they had a 13.4 win percentage and then 11.7 simple rating system. Simple rating number. We have, of course, the Philadelphia 76ers in 1976 when they come in at third on our list. As you mentioned, the Dallas Mavericks, a team that we sort of talked about a little bit of just historically bad, 93 Mavericks come in at second on my list. And then the worst team in history, according to this little basic study that I did, I'd like to actually go, you know, obviously a little bit deeper in this, but I think that they're going to come up a lot of times because when I posed the question on Twitter, a lot of people answered this one right away. It is the 2012 Charlotte Bobcats, who were the worst combination of win-loss percentage, simple rating, and all that other stuff. Just a god-awful team. And the reason I did the normalize was to try to kind of make it a little less of their strength, the strike shortened season. I didn't necessarily want to have their lockout shortened season. I don't want that to affect them too much. It didn't matter. They were still far and away worse than everybody else. So, yeah, it's congratulations to the 2012 Charlotte Bobcats for being our worst team of all time. But somebody much smarter than me do a much better study, and I would love to read it. So,
yeah. Well, they also finished worst in win-loss percentage, so they at least their record matched our conclusions. So
yes, absolutely.
But you know, you got to trust the process. That's what I always like to say. By the way, the Hornets never won their division, so the best they finished was second. They finished second in '95 and in 2002, the last year where they were the Hornets before they moved to New Orleans, but they were the Hornets, but the New Orleans Hornets. So it's confusing. Good.
I don't want them to raise a banner.
They have they have no right to any banner. So
okay, good, great.
I think we've got it covered.
That's bad teams. Yeah, we talked about them all.
Not all of them.
There's a lot more.
But you know, I think we've got enough for today. You know,
the 9-hour podcast. We're just right. On a Saturday, we will just wake up and every terrible team, we break them down in excruciating detail.
Maybe I'll call in sick for that one. You can get Curtis Harris on or something. You know,
that's fine. Oh, that'd be good. I won't come in and you can talk to Curtis. Curtis, one of us get us out of here and talk to Curtis. We'll talk for 9 hours.
See how much we can put that out. So, so anyway, everyone, of course, we are hosted on the podiumgame.com. We are part of the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network of podcasts, which you can find on iTunes, and would be lovely if you would give us and the other great podcasts that are included with, including the Podium Game Podcast, Biscast Ball, Rise and Scribe, Quo Vadimus, and other good ones. It would be great if you could leave us a review if you dig what we do. We would definitely appreciate that. Help spread the word for what we do. And you can follow us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA. We have a Facebook page of the same name. Also have our own website where we're posting some podcasts, links to podcasts, and some other content. It's been slow to go, but we're, you know, working on getting it going. You can go to overandbacknba.com to check those things out. Rich, did I forget anything?
I think that's it. You got us on Twitter, all that good stuff. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes to the Hardwood Paroxysm Network. Other than that,
we're good. That. Yeah, if you want to get in touch with us, leave best ways are to send us a tweet or leave a comment on the post at the Podium Game. That would we'd love feedback. We love hearing from people. Hopefully, you think we're doing a good job and you're enjoying the show. But anything good or constructive criticism, we'd love to hear it. So thanks again, Rich. Good discussion, and until next time, everyone, adios.